You sit down in a theater and a performer arrives on stage and tries to make you understand something, feel something. It can be a political point, an emotion, or a fairy tale. To this end, a musician sings a ballad, or an actor recites rehearsed lines, a comedian just talks, and a dancer uses their whole body. In this podcast, we talk to three artists involved in vastly different dance productions. Carl J. Lewin and Matteo Fargin are the choreographer, composer, and dancer in Extremely Bad Dancing to Extremely French Music. And Hannah Bateman is the lead soloist in the Northern Ballet's Cinderella. We start the podcast with Carl J. Lewin and Matteo Fargin, whose Extremely Bad Dancing to Extremely French Music is a humorous and intriguing series of short vignettes. These short pieces range from extremely rainy to extremely far away and hard to see to extremely vulgar. Using only Carl's choreography, Matteo's elegant piano, and silent movie-style signage, they created a piece which is as thoughtful as it is absurd. We caught up with Carl and Matteo at the Traverse Theater after a recent performance.
Hello, everybody.
It's the multicolored cultural laser. We travel the world for the boys and the girls. Casting pods of wonder and amazement. Multicolored cultural laser.
I'm Carl J. Lewin, and choreographer and performer.
I'm Matteo Fargin. I'm a composer and performer too.
Extremely Bad Dancing and Extremely French Music. Is that the... Wait, maybe you should say it.
Extremely Bad Dancing to Extremely French Music. It's an extremely memorable title, but people can never actually remember what it is. So people paraphrase and say Extremely French Dancing and what's it? Exceedingly Bad Dancing, Bad Music.
I just, when I went to get the tickets, I just said, I have to pick up tickets for Extremely. For people who haven't seen it, actually, what happens in the performance? Because it's a really special kind of idea. I really enjoyed just the way it moved.
What happens in the performance is a bunch of short piano pieces, all with the title Extremely Something, and a bunch of dances and text-based pieces, also with the name titled Extremely Something. And that's how we worked from the beginning. We worked separately to create a bank of piano pieces and a bank of pieces that Carl would do. And then we had this bank of material that we could choose from to assemble the piece.
Right. And there's like 50 of them. There's like Extremely Bad Dancing, Extremely Loud, Extremely Pedestrian, Extremely Elephant, which I think maybe is my current favorite.
Extremely Elephant, Extremely Vulgar, Extremely Italian, Wagnerian. We started off with the idea that we would make 50 each, and then that reduced to 25 each, and now I think we've probably got 25 between us.
Yeah. So how many extremelies are there during the... So like what happens is like there's a pianist and they're playing a bit of piano music, and then you're flipping these kind of old-timey like silent film cards to give us notice that the segment's changing, the scene's changing.
There's two people on stage. There's Tim Parkinson, who's a pianist, and there's myself as a dancer and performer. And we've edited together or assembled a number of short solos, as Matteo said, each with a title Extremely Something. Some of them are dance-based solos, some of them are text-based solos, and then there's the music, the piano solos. The solos are either announced with these signage, so they're kind of intertitles, so they look a little bit like the silent movie titles. Each solo is either announced, or it's beforehand or after in some cases. So you see the solo, and then it gets titled later.
So what was it like getting all of the ideas for the Extremely Blank down to the ones that would be and work together? Because I really admired how the piano pieces and the dance or text pieces kind of meshed in a really lovely way, and I was wondering how hard that was to kind of put them side by side. And did you play around with that?
Because your method of working, Matteo, which is, I think, is to always do the next most obvious thing. That's how we constructed the piece, even if perhaps it seems a little bit cliched.
The next obvious thing, but I always believe in when you're making a piece, to start from the beginning. So we really, when we'd each collected these pieces, we met in the studio and we thought, okay, what should we do first? And so it was really like, okay, you're going to do that, I'll do this. And then what do we want to see next? And I do think that Well, there's two things going on. There's the incredible, I'm not just saying that because I'm a composer, but the power of music, I think, is to color anything that's happening on stage is still surprises me now after all these years of working in theater and in dance, that how you can just play two different pieces of music with exactly the same movement and it can be such a different world. So that was really fascinating from the start. And the other thing is the titles. If you give the piece of music any title, it'll make some sense. It can be completely the wrong title. And so we're dealing with a piece of music which has a title attached to it and a piece of dance sometimes which has a title, and then you have the two things together. So it's immediately a very rich world of possibilities.
Yeah, it's quite meta because you have like basically four things which are working against or with each other at any given time, and you can kind of go in or go out of that. And I thought the beginning was great because it went from that extremely accumulative to extremely loud, which is exactly like kind of what you were saying about the obvious. I mean, it's a really natural lead on from the accumulation of years, I guess. And I loved what you did, Carl, with your face. You were painting, what was that? Pencil? Just pencil?
Eyeliner, yeah.
Onto all the wrinkles and stuff.
Yeah,
and
you got that.
That started off, actually, Matteo's piece of music is extremely accumulative in the way that the music is constructed. And originally, I think it was called Extreme Faces. I think we came up with the titles and then we made the solos. Originally, the idea was, you were talking about the genesis of the piece. I mean, the genesis of the piece was Matteo and I had worked together many, 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 many years ago when I was 30 or something. I wanted to work with Matteo again. So we had a conversation and we decided that we were happy to work together, but we had to deal with the issue of being several hundred miles apart. Matteo lives in London and I live up in the north of Scotland in Moray. What working methodology, how could we make a piece together that allowed us to stay in our home, in our homes, and for Matteo to travel less? So we came up with the idea of making these short solos. I think originally it was the idea of one a day, which I didn't manage.
I one a day. I was giving him a hard time, saying, I'm going to do one a day. And then Carl would like, oh, I've done three this week. And but then we ran out of steam. But it was a very good way. I thought it was a very good way to get Carl to work. It's true, because he's very indecisive and can be a little bit vague in his way of working. So I said, okay, I think it was my idea at the beginning. So just call a piece extreme and do anything, extremely anything, and you've got to do one a day. And then I had to put my money where my mouth was, and I had to do that too with the music. And
I think the extremely titles is also this idea that we might shake us both out of being extremely understated, but I don't think it really worked, did it?
Yeah, because the idea, I mean, I guess, like, because all of these things, the art of it, I guess, is super subtle. And so I was wondering how hard it was for you to be extreme, and because that's, when you are really extreme, it's too much, isn't it?
I think that was one of our failures, if you like, that we very soon realized that I was writing kind of elegant piano pieces and he was doing quite subtle dances. So we certainly weren't being extreme. It's not punk rock what we did by any means.
I tried to be punk rock. I tried.
Hey, you said cunt a few times.
I swear a lot.
That was for the extremely vulgar section, we should let people know. He wasn't just shouting vulgarities out without any context. Minimal context, but not without any context. How difficult was it for you, Carl, to dance badly?
I found it quite easy, yeah. On Extremely Bad Dancing, Extremely French Music, which we do a kind of rerun version later on, like a B-side remix, which we switch the titles to Extremely French Dancing to Extremely Bad Music. I mean, the difficult thing is not to fall into mockery or a pastiche of somebody else and to maintain some sense of naivety, behaving as if I'm not aware that it's bad dancing. Although tonight, the Travis performance was particularly different because the audience was so riotous. But it was very tempting to play along to the audience, which is the first time, actually, it's been so.
There was a lot of laughter and, like,
they sang along to the Internationale, to the extremely left wing.
So you tried to find a way to dance badly, but I mean, was it a level of earnestness, I guess? Or was there a feeling of, like, you don't want to make a mockery out of it? I think there seemed to be a heart in what you were performing that wasn't, it didn't make me as a bad dancer feel bad.
I don't want to mock or put anybody down. It's like feeding the dance with naivety and then let it go. And then it's feeding the idea with the notion of bad dancing and then let it go. And then I might feed it with what if I do bad dancing but do it earnestly but let it go. And I think the key thing for me in performing it is just the here and gone idea, that it's not holding on to anything and not pretending. It's a bit certain of my kind of mind trickery.
Because when I was reading your biography, it said that you started dancing at 26, which seems to me a bit late. Is it not?
Yeah, generally it's quite late. I started when I was 26, and then I started training when I was about 27, Middlesex University. I met Matteo soon after. After a couple of years.
We met in London. I should say that I started dancing when I was 40.
Yes.
So it's older.
Wow, that's super late.
My career in dance began when I was 40. So he's a spring chicken.
What brought you to take to the stage in that way? What was it that compelled you to do it?
So for me, it was a kind of desperation to be on stage again. And as a composer, I never really liked the sitting in my room for 6 months writing a string quartet and then handing it over to somebody else to play badly and then weeping at a performance and then having to write another one. So I became very interested in collaborating and realized that I was quite good at it, at writing fast and writing to demand with dance, with choreographers. And then even that was, I became disillusioned with that, and with the long-term collaborator, Jonathan Burrows, I eventually said to him, I want to perform in one of the pieces again, and I don't want to be just writing music for you. So that was in 2000, I think, and so since then I've been on stage again performing with him. And a lot of the pieces are actually movement-based pieces, so I really did have to learn to dance.
And was there something about composing for dance that was different than composing for theater? That attracted you to then, because you could have easily have been like, well, I'd like to be an actor. I would like to sing.
I'd like to do any of those. It wasn't so. It was more like not writing music for the concert stage anymore. Writing music for other things meant that you could also write stupid music, which I quite liked. It didn't have to be music that needed necessarily to hold its own. That it could be music that, in a way, supported or had a conversation with something else going on, and that kind of suited me more, I think.
I like the stupid thing. It kind of relates anyway, because when I was 26. I started doing creative movement classes, you know, pretending I was a chicken breaking out of an egg, and then I progressed to bigger birds and eventually birds that could fly. And somebody who I respected said, you're really good, you should go off and train. So I went off to university and immersed myself in the world of dance. And the strange thing was, you know, I was 10 years older than, and a different gender to most of the people that were in the dance class. And because I hadn't got a background in ballet and I hadn't been doing it since I was small, and I had a child and I didn't have a lot of time, I thought that the best way to get myself on stage is if I choreograph dances that I can do. So I began by doing dances that had walking and lying and standing, because I could do that quite well, and then I progressed. Jonathan Burrows actually recommended that I ask Matteo to write some music for one of my dances, which is, and that was 100 years ago.
And you, because you had a background in sort of politics and social action, social, Carl, which I guess comes out from the very beginning of the show, actually, I think. Does that always work its way into your work, or was that hard to break away from in terms of moving into the dance world?
No, not really. I mean, when in my 20s, the kind of anarchist, revolutionary world that I was living in, and but it hasn't really played a major part in my life. But I was quite interested in when I was turning 50 and reflecting on my life and looking at what I'd carried with me and I liked and what I'd left behind. I think looking around at the world, I felt quite impotent. I didn't feel like I was making a lot of difference in the world, so I had this grand idea of being more overtly political in this piece, but it again proved quite difficult. And even though we have two solos entitled Extremely Left Wing and Extremely Right Wing, they're more they do have political references, but they're, what want to say, I think on Extremely Left Wing, I don't know what to say about it really. It's like within Extremely Left Wing, where there's an attempt to a subtle attempt to rouse audience or people into joining me along with that impotent feeling.
That is activism, right? It's an attempt to rally people around you, and the constant sadness of not being able to do it quite enough. And I think that was articulated really well in the piece, through the internationality, and even with the amount of people who were trying to sing along and couldn't sing along. So there was about 5 people trying to sing along in the audience, and that really quite it had that feeling of activism, which is like we're all trying, but we're all on a different page and singing a different verse, and sometimes it comes together, and you're making these great motions of like solidarity and community. Yeah, I really felt that was happening.
I mean, I think the mistake is that the piece doesn't have any kind of pinned down meaning. It's not about anything in particular. It has some ideas, and there's some kind of odd, kind of absurd logic that links all the different sections together, but it's not about anything in particular. And I think the if it succeeds, it's anything it succeeds as not in, it doesn't interpret the content on behalf of the audience, so people can read a whole load of different things into it, and that's what I'm interested in anyway.
It seems also a piece, I mean, when I saw it tonight, it certainly has a kind of poignancy to it, and it felt to me, but I saw it really as a piece about failing, and obviously also a piece about aging. You know, but, although I'm not performing in this piece, it for me it's a kind of it's quite a sad piece anyway. It's funny too, but it does have a kind of, you know, that kind of I can't go on. I must go on. Yeah. I must try again, and this time I'll do it with this piece of music, and this time I'll do it with my shirt off. But I'll keep trying.
Carl J. Lewin and Matteo Fargin, everybody. You can find out more information about the piece and other dance works on Carl's website, carljlewin.info. Our next guest is featured in the Northern Ballet's Cinderella. Though it is a classic tale, the company has boldly commissioned a new score for the production set in Imperial Russia. Instead of a fairy godmother, we have a magician, and in this version, Prince Charming seems a little bit more fallible, and the evil stepsisters, not so malicious. Hannah Bateman, who plays one of these stepsisters, sat down with us to explain.
Hannah Bateman.
Maybe just tell us a little bit about the performance for people who haven't had a chance to see it yet.
Well, we use the traditional fairy tale, and then there's a couple of twists in it. So our version's actually set in Imperial Russia, and then you have your classic Cinderella who's mistreated by her stepmother and her 2 sisters. They're not ugly sisters this time. They're just kept separate from her. They're not really allowed to hang out and play with her. They're good friends with her, but not in front of their mother. We meet Cinderella when she's a very young girl, and she meets the prince at a big family picnic, and then she doesn't meet him again until the famous ball scene. And she always kind of has that image in her mind and that dream perhaps of meeting him again, and then it's not until the culmination of the ballet that all of that comes together. So there's a happy ending.
You play one of the 2 sisters, the mm-hmm. not ugly stepsisters, and also, I guess I was wondering in terms of the character that you're playing, they're not mean. I expected them to be
mean. No, they're not mean. They're kind of just really influenced by their mum. They're really under the thumb, and they just are absolutely terrified of her and do exactly as she says. So even when that means that they kind of participate in the bullying of Cinderella, if it's what their mother's told them to do, then they do it just because they're completely terrified of her and the reaction that she will have, and perhaps maybe one day that they might get treated the same way as Cinderella does. So they're witness to all of this cruelty, but they're powerless to do anything about it.
It's a really interesting dynamic that because the mother is constantly touching them, pushing them back, and doing all these things to kind of separate them, but it seems like they actually quite have an affinity for the little girl.
No, definitely. I think certainly the way that myself and Michaela, who's the other sister, how we've played it is that actually we adore Cinderella. Like, she's so much fun and she's lovely. She is the image of the perfect young girl, and we want to be part of that and have her in our lives, but our mother absolutely hates her, and that's how we're taught to respond to her. So when our mother's not around, then we have those sort of close moments, but if she's around, then we have to be completely separate from her.
Yeah, there's that great scene where they all get an invitation to the big ball, and then Cinderella actually gets one as well, and they're actually quite happy for her until...
I quite like that, because that's a very different take on how other people have portrayed Cinderella, but there's this sort of this mad couple of minutes when just there is 3 young girls who are just all so thrilled to be invited to this ball, and then there's the complete change in dynamic as the as the mother, the stepmother, enters the stage, and then they all know that suddenly all of that happiness is over.
As a performer, how does it work in terms of just trying to find that characterization? How does it work without, you know, just using your body and just using dance in order to convey some of these things? Does your style change based on the character, or do you allow your style to inform who the character is going to be?
I think it's a bit of both, and you find it as you create the ballet as a whole. It's going to be very dependent on who you are, who the character is, how old the character is, whereabouts they are in their life, and then their dynamic with the other characters that are on stage. You just find it as you go, and then you know in certain scenes when to kind of pull back a bit, support the other roles, and then when are the moments that you can be really bold with your character. And I mean, that's the beauty of it as well, because it's always evolving, and because this is still so very new for us and we still have a long way to go with it tour wise it's still developing, and for me, I think it's getting stronger and stronger, so it's a very interesting process.
There is a moment where you had some of these very strange kind of, I'm going to do a total disservice to your art by describing it in the most, you know, layman of terms, but like a very glitchy kind of like thing, which was a very playful kind of young childish thing to do, and that seemed to be a fundamental part of that character.
I'm glad that you noticed that, because that's kind of what we struggled with a bit at the beginning, was because Michaela and I are the sisters through the whole ballet, whereas Cinderella is played by two people, so a younger version and then an older version. So Michaela and I had to portray that development of age in ourselves, so it's quite hard to be young and not do a silly version of it, to do it like a genuine young person's movement rather than just someone that's being a bit silly, and then sort of mature as the ballet goes on. And then, but you find that in the language, and also our language as sisters had to be slightly different to Cinderella's, because she needed to have, say, a bit more of a lyrical, more of a sophisticated movement compared to us. So hopefully that's what came across.
In terms of developing something like this, are you talking about kind of working on it as you perform it, as you go on through the tour, and which is going to be lasting, I think, until November, December?
Yeah, it goes on to the end of this year. So
how does that work? Is that a very collaborative process? Do you bring things to the director?
We're given a lot of room to try things out today, and especially as you're going along, as you're performing and you're getting used to the team that's around you, the same dancers, things start to develop, and you'll become aware of certain, I don't know, moments in the ballet when you think, oh, actually, maybe I could try that a bit differently, and it would make that moment stronger for the audience. Because what we notice on stage sometimes doesn't always carry across. And if it's something that you think is worthy, that will support the story, the narrative, then, yeah, in rehearsals and things like that, we certainly bring it up and say, I've noticed this, how does that sit with you? There has to be value in it for the audience.
I guess it has to advance that sort of narrative and that story,
yeah.
Which...
That's the only reason to really do something, is if it supports the story and it supports the dancers around you. If it's sort of making all of that stronger, then, and the message is getting across clearer.
Having talked to a lot of people who are involved in dance, I think it's so easy to forget when you're watching it from a stage, when you're looking at like the elegance and the gliding and everybody's moving perfectly, like exactly how hard that is. You know, I can't walk down the street in good posture for more than 5 minutes, you know, like to do that for an hour, 2 hours on stage in front of people, and every movement being perfected, it's got to take a huge amount of concentration and then physical exertion. And I didn't notice that many people sweating.
Oh no, they are. They've just probably got a really good sort of foundation base thing going on their face, so you won't see it. No, they are. I mean, but again, that's really personal. So some people's bodies just, I suppose you'd say, operate on a higher level, and they'll sweat a lot and they'll get to their maximum work level really quickly, and other people will be, you know, they won't even get warm, and that's just the way their bodies react. So, but trust me, everybody on that stage is working really hard, because it's tough. It's a really difficult job. But by the time you get to stage, hopefully you've done enough of that sort of real graft in the studio that you can forget that side of it and just be there in the moment in the story. So that's why it's nice on stage, because there's kind of a numbness that comes over your body, and you don't really realize physically what you're doing, and it's only the next day that maybe you're a bit sore.
You never get the thing where you're just thinking, that was really hard, why aren't you notice that?
Yeah, I think that's what's interesting about our work, is that our effort is to make it as seamless as possible, is to not tell you how hard we're trying. And I think what's interesting for me is perhaps when you're watching, I don't know, something like Strictly Come Dancing, is how the audience love to clap when there's like a big lift or something. But when you're in the theatre, you try and make those things seamless so that you want people to notice that that girl's in that incredibly high lift, but you don't want it to be like an amazing shock. It's just sort of, there's a natural progression that she's ended up in the air, and that it's sort of smooth, and so that you're just kind of hypnotized by it all in a way.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like it's showy or circusy. I mean, the moments in the performance, you had some great circus performers there.
Moments like that, but it's important that they're there because it fits with the story, not because it's, hey, look how strong I am. You know, that doesn't make any sense.
I'm wondering, what's the difference for you between doing something like Cinderella, which is a kind of, I mean, this is a great telling of it, and it's much different than any other version, but it's essentially, you know, the same Grimm's fairy tale story, and doing something maybe more contemporary or modern, like I know you did something called Project Number One, which is, it seems a lot more minimalist.
Yes.
A lot more contemporary. What are the differences and the challenges in each of those, I guess I'm wondering?
The differences are literally the fact that perhaps Cinderella is a really well-known story and everybody will come with an expectation of that story, and whereas Project One, it didn't have an obvious narrative. When we work, we would always have a narrative, a general theme for all of the dancers within that group to get behind, so that you had a really cohesive energy behind the work. For me, I like a mix of both.
In terms of mixture of narrative and theme?
Yeah, so I love narrative work. And I like the parameters of it and the way that it's very strict and you have to stick with the story and the characters and all of those sorts of things. But then when you do something like Project One, then there's also, what's enjoyable about that is the complete scope of it. And it's a brand new, never been done before work, and you're building it from the ground up. So that's really interesting.
Do you have more input in one over the other in terms of the movements you're making, or is it?
Actually, that's interesting, because narrative work, if you're at the very beginning of it, so when that piece is created from scratch, the person that you're creating it with, so the choreographer, and then you're given the character, it's as much your responsibility to bring as much to that role as the choreographer. So that's a real kind of collaborative work. Whereas something like Project One, that was choreographed by Kenneth Tindall, he had a very, very clear vision. He has a very distinct language of his own as a choreographer. So that's your source. It's that choreographer, and it's trying to be as kind of true to how that person wants you to execute each and every step. It's as if you've been given a text and then you're reading the words on the page, and you want to say them as exactly as you can to how the person that wrote it. So that's, I think that's the best way I can describe it.
that can be quite frustrating.
Actually, I suppose some people might find it frustrating, but there's a real challenge in it, and to physically execute something that somebody is developing there in front of you is very interesting. But it is really tough.
Because it's got to be so precise, and what's in their head to translate that in movement to somebody else. You can't just...
They're giving you all of the information, and they're telling you how they're working and visually how they're seeing their work, and then you're seeing them move and translating that and putting it into your own body, and then hopefully your interpretation comes out as something that they recognize. So that's the gist of it.
And they don't say, do it again.
Yeah. Or they say, that's great, do it again.
Hannah Bateman, everybody. You can follow her on Twitter at Hannah14Bateman. The Northern Ballet Cinderella is touring the country all year, and you can find out where and about other productions on northernballet.com. And before we go, we want to share a little excerpt from our Scottish Poetry Library podcast, which is released this Monday, April the 7th. When I was in South Korea, I got a chance to meet the poet Lee Si-young, and he's a fantastic poet. He writes these really brilliant poems. He lived through the military dictatorship there in South Korea in the 70s and 80s. He's a really vibrant and interesting character. We got a chance to sit down with him and his translator, Brother Anthony. Brother Anthony, also a very interesting person. He happens to be the only Cornish Korean, possibly in the entire world. And it's a super pleasure to share this podcast with you. So we're just going to give you a little taste of what it sounds like. Here he is, Lee Si-young with Brother Anthony. My feeling has always been with political poems, which is something that yours don't do. They're not angry, it doesn't seem like. It doesn't seem like they're directly telling people how to think or what to feel, but they are giving a very clear feeling and a very clear emotion, as opposed to lecturing and trying to teach you something about politics.
Without something which emerges from the depths of the human heart, you cannot have a poem. If it comes out of the head or out of some kind of anger or political opinion, that's not poetry.
Was it hard during your life to not get angry and not allow that to get into your work? Because I imagine you were angry at times, but to make the work out of love and to honor that feeling to come from your heart, was that hard at times? Did you have to throw away a lot of poems that were just too angry, too bitter, and not coming from a place of sensitivity?
If I'm simply angry, then nothing will come out in terms of poetry. It has to be transformed somehow deep within me, and has to emerge from, be the expression of my deep inner heart. That's the only way then that it can be poetry. And to be a poet essentially is to be somebody who celebrates and sings about love.
Lisha Young and Brother Anthony, everybody. You can hear the full podcast from the Scottish Poetry Library by checking out scottishpoetrylibrary.podomatic.com. Also, make sure to follow the Scottish Poetry Library on the Twitter at By Leaves We Live. That's all for our podcast this week. We'll be back in your ears again next week. Same Culture Laser channel, same Culture Laser time. Until then, goodbye for now.
Casting pots of wonder and amazement. Cultural.